This program is brought to you by Cabinet, a nonprofit arts organization based in Brooklyn, New York. Cabinet depends on your support to continue our activities. For more information, visit us online at cabinetmagazine.org.
The following recording is of Bulbs, Tubes, Beams, and Cobra Heads, a panel and screening with artist Amy Granite, curator Gregor Jansen, and environmental psychologist Linnea Tillett, moderated by curator Sarah DeMuse. The event was organized by the Goethe Institute New York and took place December 7th, 2011.
Amy is an experimental filmmaker, as you all saw. She also paints and performs, and she's based here in New York. Amy's work has been shown... Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. So Amy's work has been shown in solo format in New York in places such as the New Museum, Sculpture Center, and the Kitchen, and also abroad at Le Confort Moderne, Basis Frankfurt, and Galerie Eva Presenhuber in Zurich. In 2008, a film that she made together with Drew Heisler was included in the Whitney Biennial. And like myself, Amy is a Bard College graduate, and she currently teaches at the MFA program in NYU. Linnea Tillett, our second speaker of the night, is a principal and founder of Tillett Lighting Design. A lighting designer and environmental psychologist, she has extensive experience in the analysis of and design for public urban nighttime, or nighttime space, sorry. Linnea's work is represented in New York City at Battery Bosque, under the Brooklyn Bridge at the Dumbo exit, in Far Rockaway Park, Peck Slip, Brooklyn Navy Yard, and in East New York. Outside of New York, she's currently working on projects with Michael van Valkenburg, Beyer Blinder Belle, Maya Lin, Toshiko Mori, and Clear. And then finally, we have Gregor Jansen, who just joined us today from Düsseldorf. Gregor Jansen studied art history, building history, philosophy, sociology, and political science at the RWTH in Aachen. After completing his doctorate in 1998, he worked as a curator, art critic, and freelance writer, and lectured in image science and media theory. Between 2005 and 2009, Gregor headed the ZKM, Museum of Contemporary Art in Karlsruhe, where he curated shows such as Light Art from Artificial Light, and I'm sure we'll hear more about that tonight, Totalstadt Beijing Case, Michael Kunze, and Vertrautes Terrain. In November 2009, he was appointed director at the Kunsthalle Düsseldorf, where he assumed his duties in January 2010. Gregor, or Dr. Jansen, is since this year a guest professor at the Kunstakademie in Münster. And Amy and Linnea and Gregor are basically here all together and will be sharing a table because of an exhibition that is currently on view in the East Village at the Goethe Institute's Wyoming building. The show is called We Would Provide Complete Darkness, and it features work by Kitty Krauss. This is actually an installation view from the show. These are untitled light boxes that she makes. There's another work by Carsten Nicolai, which is called Future Past Perfect, Sononda. And then we have a third work by Heike Baranowski, which is called Mondfahrt. This show was actually originally conceived by Alphonse Hoog, so I came in a second stage. But roughly speaking, what the show does is it brings together meditations on light. Light either, as a drawing material, light as having some sort of sculptural qualities, and this work also has a sound element to it, so there's connections with Amy's presentation, actually. And then finally, light as some kind of guiding post through the dark night. There's also a publication component to the show. You see small inserts in between these books, gray little butterfly-backed folders, which are actually also inserted somewhere over here in cabinet. These talk more about light as a metaphor for knowledge and for ordering knowledge. So those are the components of the show. But what we wanted to do today is not really repeat what is proposed at the Wyoming building. I thought it would be more interesting that we consider or experiment with the impact of light on our perceptive mechanisms. And when I say light, I mean either a very blatant manipulation of light sources or also more modest or subtle interventions in the lighting scheme. What is of interest to me is how a thing as intangible as light, a photon or a packet of photons, has such far-reaching and really conditioning impacts on the human being. It's kind of the invisible hand in architecture, urbanism, systems of vigilance, safety, and in our psychic state. The light wave is a key player behind us using, desiring, or breaking objects. And as a metaphor for inside, it's charged in equal amount with problems as it is with simple beauty. One may even suggest that being human implies being a clever, at times evil manipulator of or subject to light. So having three different practitioners here tonight, I hope will unlock some black boxes and will open our eyes to the specific intentions of those who direct or dim the lights. And I'm thinking of changes in moods, atmosphere, or the morphing of spatial experience. So in bringing these people together, I hope that the more universal or symbolical metaphors find a counterweight in specifics and in real matter. Tonight, we'll first continue with another screening by Amy. This film is called Landscape Film. And then we'll move on to Linnea, followed by Gregor. And afterwards, I really hope you'll join me in an informal Q&A about the work that you've seen or just other related questions. So without further ado, I also want to thank our friends at Cabinet and our friends at the Goethe Institute, all of whom have really helped and make this a great evening that is technically also working fairly well. So Amy, I think we should return blackness to you and go for it.
Good evening, Amy. That was absolutely ravishing. I'm going to talk about something sort of rather more prosaic, which is the topic of street lighting. And as Sarah said, I'm an environmental psychologist as well as a lighting designer, and I thought I would explain a little bit about what that means, what my work looks like. And I thought I'd just share a story and see if it's helpful. I saw somebody last Saturday that I see pretty much once a month, actually. He cuts my hair, and he's very sensitive and thinks a lot about lighting. We talk a lot about lighting. And I sort of plopped myself down in his chair and said how I was sort of exhausted. And he said, what were you doing this week? And I said, well, you know, on Tuesday, I think we could show this now. Thanks. On Tuesday, I was out in the street outside my office and walking around in the street, and I was trying to decide which of two light bulbs was better for an installation that I'm doing in Syracuse, and sort of just looking at them and thinking which was domestic and which one was more rugged. And that took some time. And then I jumped into a train and went down to Washington, D.C. I'd been asked by an arts organization if I would come and take a look at these beautiful steps that they had built with some kids in the neighborhood. It's a rather poor community, and the kids work at the Y, and they didn't light them. And then they realized that people were frightened of them at night, so I jumped in a train and I went down there. And when I got there, not only was the arts organization there, but also a specialist in gang violence from the police department, and also a specialist in lighting from the police department. And we walked around the neighborhood for a couple of hours. And, of course, it was quite a terrifying experience and in some ways, mostly because I didn't know my way around. But we looked at all these different places where we might put lighting, or what would happen if we lit the stairs but didn't light the house next to it, and what would we throw in shadow, and what would come into light. And then I jumped in a train and came back to New York, and the next night I was out on the Roosevelt Memorial, out on Roosevelt Island, the Four Freedoms Park that's just about to open, and we spent a couple of hours walking around that and noticing that on that park, the moon, even at half brightness, half full, it was so bright that we could see our own shadows. and we were really almost half-hearted about adding any light at all. So I finished this story to my friend Yutaka, and Yutaka said, you know, this is really weird, but I just realized that you work at night, and that's sort of embarrassing. I've known you for years, and I said, you know, Yutaka, it's not embarrassing at all. People hire me all the time, and I say, I'd like to see the site at night, and they look at me, and they say, why? So I always make a point now of saying, I work at night, and now you know a little bit about what my work looks like. In our studio, we're, I would say, not entirely consumed by, but mostly consumed by the questions about mobility and transit. There's an old kind of little question that philosophy professors often ask their students at the beginning of the term, and they say to them, why don't trees have eyes? And usually there's some bright spark in the room who will say something like, correctly, because they don't have feet. Obvious, but still. So this, you know, connection, trees can't move forward for what they need or what they want, and they can't move away from things that are bad for them or possibly terrifying, but we can, and we spend a remarkable amount of time every day moving toward things that we want or need or have to go to and away from things that we're done with or often terrified of. So this idea of how to sort of manipulate or enhance or think about more deeply the nighttime environment as it pertains to people moving between one thing and another leads you often to a kind of obsession with the lamppost, not something most of you are obsessed with, but it's sits out there on this little region of pavement, and it's contested often with, you know, fire hydrants and post boxes, and you know, it has to sort of find its own room. And as this drawing that Charlie at my office did very quickly this afternoon, because I asked him to put it all in one image, you know, birds sit on it, and that's not all they do. People lean their bikes on it. People put notices on it. Dogs pee on it. It's just a kind of stick with a lamp on the top, but it's taken on an enormous importance in our psyche and our experience of the street. So we think about lampposts a lot. Alex is here from my studio, and I think often when people think they're coming to work for me that it's going to be this wildly creative experience, and often they spend all this time looking at lampposts and various things like bollards. So I'm going to ask you for a moment to imagine the difference between walking in the street during the day and at night, and this is so you can understand a bit about the lamppost. When you leave your house during the daytime, you walk out into what's essentially a very democratic visual experience. The sun just beats down on everyone. It doesn't care who you are or what you're wearing or how much money you make. It just hits everything. And you have this kind of fairly well evolved visual system. You can see color and detail. You can move your head from side to side. But I think sort of most critically, you can make choices about what you look at. You can make selections. You can say, oh, that's interesting to me. I want to look at that. And it might be boring to someone else, but you have to do your laundry. You look at where the laundry is. You can look in a store and say, okay, that's kind of fascinating. I'm interested in getting shoes. Or you can see the sunlight on a piece of stone or glass and think, oh, that's an aesthetic fact. I find that so lovely. And you can do this with a tremendous amount of freedom and almost a lack of awareness of what you're doing. Your body actually tends to have these like little mini perceptions that go on while you're walking, and it sort of tells you where to go And a lot of people even describe this as like a zombie experience. You're just walking, you're thinking about yourself, you know, love, food, petty humiliations, whatever, things that make you who you are. And at the same time, you're noticing these things. And, you know, if you get lost, you look at a sign and you look at stop, go. That's not what happens at night. At night, you step out. And you're in an environment where you're essentially not, in some way, by our species development, supposed to be. We have absolutely crappy vision at night. We can't see detail. We can't see color. We become very heightened in our awareness. I'm not sure what the next slide is, so I'm just going to hit it. Oh, there we go. And we have actually a visual system that mostly operates at the very edge of our eyes, not ahead, so that, you know, that's where astronomers look. They always look from this side. So we're actually, the fact that we can go out and at night is in some way a measure of how much we want a social life and how brave we are. And if you think about the fact that for most of human history there was no public lighting, it's astonishing. I also want to just mention that as a species, you know, as a diurnal species, we lack any of the basics that other nocturnal species have. We can't make our own light. We don't have luciferins. We can't change color and stun our prey like cephalopods. We don't have eyes on the side of our head like rabbits so that we could actually see what's happening at the edge. And maybe somewhat most importantly, we don't have a little reflector at the back of our eyes like cats that enhance the lighting and collect it. So when you go out at night, most of the time, when it's dark, your brain is screaming to a certain extent, where is it? Where am I? Where's the edge? Where are the bumps? Is the edge of the pavement? Where? And things which during the daytime might have seemed sort of enchanting actually take on a sort of more perhaps lurid appearance. And then you come to the most sort of critical issue about nighttime, is that we live in a city of strangers. Going out at night is the engagement of strangers. People not only are you not related to or familiar with, not your friends, but also people who may inhabit a totally different symbolic world or cultural world. So actually, while your part of your brain is going where, the other part of your brain is going who. Who is it? Who's coming at me? You know, where's the tiger? But mostly we concern ourselves with who. So going back to the sort of historic facts is, again, we have been traveling around the world. We have been writing, we've been creating, we've been making friends and making war at night for almost all of human history. And we did it by using the moon. And there are other devices which I could describe, but I won't. But primarily we did it by carrying our own light, which was also kind of oddly democratic because I have my light, you have your light, we look at each other, we survey each other. But at some point, the state felt that they had to step in. And this is how they stepped in. In the beginning, they mandated that people put lights over their doors. Anyone who owned a house had to put a light over their door. But that didn't work very well because some people just wouldn't do it. So then they thought, okay, we've got a better idea. We're going to string the light across the street. And, you know, in some parts of the world, this is still the way that it's done. But it didn't have the identity. It didn't give a sort of municipal character to the street. It sort of sits above your head. So then they began to put light posts on the street, but they didn't measure the distance. They were more like markers and beacons. And then they began to develop into a security device. And you begin to see light is the same as a policeman, and people feel more safe with light, and they begin to go more light, more safe, more safe. And then here in America, we took all of them out in 1961, pretty much in most major American cities in America, and we went to hell with the street. We're just interested in automobiles, so we're not going to light the edge. So we stuck Cobra heads all over. And then about 15 years ago, everyone went, doesn't work. Sorry, we want to feel safe. We want to have those nice lights. We need beat markers and beacons. So we introduced them back again. And now we're in this kind of quite interesting period where we begin to carry our own light again. We're putting it on our bicycles, mandated, or we're carrying it in our iPads or iPhones. In fact, we're beginning to create our own sort of lanterns. And then there is this cacophony of light that has now become increasingly acceptable as a sort of a visual environment. And more and more people are beginning to wonder whether there are other alternatives. So I'm going to end here by just talking about a project that I'm doing in Syracuse, which I'm doing with an artist. And her name is Ray Ogdogan. And Ray has been teaching me how to see again. Because I was so focused on street lighting and lampposts that I needed to be in this space with someone who could think outside of it, but wasn't, as it were, as Gregoire is going to talk, a light artist. But so she and I walked these streets over and over again. And I said, well, what could we do that I don't understand? And she said, well, you could put lights up in pairs. You could put lights up in trios. You could have signposts that are painted bright red with no light at all. You could match the light to the bicycle path. And then we began to look at, well, what could be a light? Well, a billboard could be a light. We could paint on walls and only cars would illuminate. We could paint underneath railway bridges. We could get the garage owners to paint on the inside. They could all become lights. And it's a very significant collaboration for me, and maybe how I understand also working with artists is that they teach you a different way of seeing. And that's all. Thank you.
Yes. I'm so happy to be here. Thanks to Goethe, thanks to Kabinet, thanks to Sarah, to everybody. Thanks for coming. Yeah, it's a pleasure. Because when I was informed that there's a light art exhibition going on in New York, curated or initiated by Alphonse Hook, dealing with the Aleph, I was a little bit irritated. I said, oh, what's going on there? What is the Aleph? And I tried to read the Borges essay again. And also I was wondering what are cobra heads when I read the invitation, but now I'm closer to it. And also thanks a lot to Amy. That was new for me, but I have a later link, you know already, this Linier film, what combines different aspects of the beginning of the idea what light could be and how dark it was in the very beginning. And so this, for example, is for me a relation to the book of Genesis in the Bible, because in the beginning was the word. Also in German it's called Am Anfang war das Wort. Am Anfang war das Wort. It sounds very serious. But of course it was very dark. But there are a lot of words. And as we saw already in the urban scenery during daylight, that the most important thing was, of course, the traffic light in the center. And light is information. Light is really the substance of activities, maybe. But what I think is very important, that if you see the world map with night on Earth, 140 years ago, it was completely dark. There was nothing to see. There was really, the Earth without light. And we did at ZKM, we did an exhibition dealing with the aspects of light and also with artificial light was already mentioned, was 2005. That was, as we understood, the wide range of what happened since the 20s or the 1920s, when artists decided to work with light as a special media, as a immaterial media. And we found out that it came from the urban sceneries, that it came exactly from artists in the Czech region or in the eastern part of Europe. They developed special forms where light was important or where light was involved in a very abstract manner. But of course, in the movies, in the 20s, like Hans Richter, Victor Egeling, Walter Ruttmann, also some experimental movie makers, try to find out what really light is and how light functions. So I think we can start, but now we have to switch. Here? Where is it? Oh, yeah. Here. And then this one. Okay. Is there a sound? This is a movie released in 1935. But it should be the restored version, but it looks not like this. Is it readable? Thank you. So this amazing movie was not hired or paid by the Post, but it was, of course, the idea behind was by Lin Li to sell it. And maybe we learn a little bit more about your idea, what is behind. But I think working on and with celluloid and painting directly on the material, or I think like you did with scratching it or manipulating the surface, is maybe similar. But
yeah, we can talk about it now later.
Yeah.
But also, Lin Li was a postman. I don't know, did you mention that?
He was a postman. Oh, okay.
That's why you see the reference in
this
work.
That movie looks like it could have been made last year.
Exactly.
The style, the visuals, and I was wondering, was the soundtrack made at the time in 1935?
Yeah, it's original.
Okay.
Cuban reference.
It could have been 6 months old.
Okay. Okay, no, but I think Amy's work, of course, is more conceptual and really dealing with other topics. But you see, I think you are right in formalistic idea. That's, of course, yeah.
What happened is a lot of that work was a little bit lost somewhere in history. So there's a huge amount of work that's similar that's kind of lost. But it was very
And for me, it was, of course, important because the early cinema in Germany was called Lichtspiele, Lichtspielhäuser, that's light games or something. I don't know what here maybe was the same?
Light play.
Light play?
Play of light.
Play of light, yeah.
Well, and of here.
Yeah, I saw it maybe here. It's there. No? It was always cinema. Never another. Yeah. So the other thing is, to the historical reference, I want to present this little movie, but it's we cannot enlarge it. We don't know why. But that was the exhibition Lichtkunst aus Kunstlicht, also light art from artificial light, that is now in the ZKM. That's Peter Weibel. Some people didn't know him before, so here he is present. And this 100 year or almost 100 year, that's Carsten Höller, for example, but we had 250 artists with 350 artworks, installations at Sylvie Fleury. So we switched out all the lights in the museum. That's Mike Kelly. So we try to illuminate the entire building, the entire space of the museum, only with the that's Anthony McCall, only with the artworks. And the people loved it. The audience was overwhelmed. That was the most successful exhibition in the ZKM ever did. But the art critic said, every Christmas market is nicer than this art show. See, that's for John Armleder with Korean light trees. So there was really like, but we tried to explain how the light develops, how it came from the urban sceneries, how... Yeah, architects were like light designers involved in this illumination of cities. That's a little disco, a one-man disco, where you can step in. And this show was really a big success, but on the other side, it was really a tragedy. It was it was very expensive, and of course, it was not successful in the art feuilletons. But okay. Just to give you an example, maybe you also saw the book. We produced a big book, like a documentation, because it starts with the dualism of light, and also that we only see in this wide range of the spectrum of light. We only see this little, frequencies. It's not a big thing we really perceive. And also that then they found out a few years ago that, of course, 70 or maybe more percent in the universe is dark material, dark or the black energy, dark energy. So we are still searching for more than the visible aspects of artificial light or sunlight. So now I have to go back. Close this. Okay. Oh, yeah. So these are some examples. Links Egeling, left. Left is Egeling, in the center is Walter Ruttmann, and right is Zdeněk Peschanek with the kinetic sculpture that was presented in Prague. That was a public sculpture, and it's now it was made 1929 to 1930, and it's now a piece in a museum. But of course, that was the future. There was maybe the core idea of modernism. So illumination and light was, of course, always positive. The term enlightenment, of course, is very positive. And I'm tonight here maybe a little bit the bad guy, talking about also some negative aspects. Here are some examples like Dan Flavin or François Morellet from the 60s, also Guy Saunier from the late 60s. That is the view into the exhibition. And this big piece here, this is, of course, more interesting for me because this is a sculpture entitled Black Hole. So everything is concentrated in a center, in an invisible center, and all the things are saugen. Sucked in this black little hole. Also, light goes in, things go in, and some other aspects, of course, also referring to coming from the pop art are the ads, the neon ads in the shopping windows, or the Deep Blue by Maurizio Nannucci, or Spencer Finch. What for me start then with the other aspect, What Time Is It on the Sun is the title of this piece, but he did a quite similar one, what we showed at ZKM, and it was, sorry, where is it? Because now I don't follow my lecture, I go a little bit quicker through. The other one was called Sunlight in an Empty Room, Passing Cloud for Emily Dickinson from 2004. And the piece was inspired in part by Emily Dickinson's poem, Before I Had My Eye Put Out, in which she describes her intense desire for visual stimulation. The artist measured exactly the color of the sunlight in Dickinson's garden in Amherst, Massachusetts, I think, and recreated it using an array of 100 fluorescent lamps. In addition, the color and intensity of light under the shadow of an artificial created passing cloud was modeled after nature conditions using 8 different color filters. So if you walk into this space, and of course Spencer Finch, probably people know him, he is also a stage designer and did this Foresight collaborations of with Bob Wilson, that you really use, or you need sunglasses in a space like this. It's like sunlight. And you have to go behind these foils and to have the impression that then there is a cloud and the sun is a little bit hidden, but otherwise you really get blind. And the idea of my text was based also on another old story. I forgot. This is an artist based in Brooklyn, Chris Martin, and this is in the Kunsthalle right now in Düsseldorf. And his piece is also entitled Staring into the Sun, referring to a lot of other aspects like the myth, like what happened after death. It's like when the body or the soul moves into another stage, maybe. But also the idea, if you look into the sun, it's really dangerous for your eyes. we are not, or our eyes are not made for seeing getting knowledge by seeing the total information. So this is once more Bjørn Dahlem, the piece by Bjørn Dahlem, Dark Hole. And also this is one aspect should be very well known, but a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. In 1977, a motion picture opened with this lead-in, a richly spun fairy tale that at that time was given little chance of recouping its production costs. After the Vietnam War, the Watergate scandal, oil and business crisis, there were particular topics that were evaluated in the film industry as being completely unsuitable, war and science fiction. Thus, while some films were successful that engaged with the citizens' trauma or were consciously designed as problem fields for individual groups, no producer could really get enthusiastic about the young director George Lucas' Star Wars, which, nourished by fairy tales, westerns, and knightly legends, emphasized mysticism and war, and then relocated the whole scenario to an archaic, technologized space in the bargain. Nevertheless, the dark side of power and its steeped in black concretization, Darth Vader and the swishing laser swords of poor light became symbols of the unlimited play instinct of power-addicted world leaders and fascinated a whole generation. It must be added that at that time computer games did not yet exist, but in this saga, in the saga's wake, video game emporia bloomed, and in the 1980s, George Lucas Entertainment products rose to become top sellers in game heaven. So this is just an example that how the film industry, of course, used these laser swords, or also the white figure of Luke Skywalker and the black figure of Darth Vader were shown. The other example is the Truman Show, and this is like a cobra head falling down from this artificial sky, and it is one of the stars or the sun during the day or the stars in the night, what comes from the studio sky or ceiling, and illuminates normally Truman's world. The other one is what I called here now the mad tricks, the mad kitsch. Of course, it's when it changed, for example, then the good guys also wear black dresses. What was in George Lucas' novel, of course, or fairy tale, of course, only Darth Vader's dress. But that light, or that you see that then the construction of the world is really like an like light dots, or like these light the numbers which appear only in these numbers falling down like light rays. Or another piece, but what is not the dark light, but of course is referring to this Catholic idea also, what is in the Bible mentioned with the separation of the bright and the dark side, is of course Gerhard Richter's window in the Cologne Cathedral. Or, for example, the inauguration of the new station, the Berlin station, a few years ago, which was a big event with laser lights and things like that. No, this is it looks not like this, but if you go in the cathedral and you look out, what is the direction south? You have the Richter visible there. It was 3 years ago, I think, when it was made by him. Yeah. And you see, these are only these pixel-like squares. I don't know how many, but very impressive. Of course, the Nazis used these light domes and the insinuation of light. And so, especially in Germany, I think we are very... sensitive what also how to use light and really how to make like also what you see here, what happened in Berlin, how to use it fascinating aspect of sceneries which of course attract. And I found that Paul Virilio wrote an interesting essay, and that's the next text I want to read. So according to Paul Virilio, we are continually coming to the limits of our capacity to see and have an ever-increasing need of artificial assistance and machinery. Perception itself is a war of images, a field of battle. In his The Aesthetic of Disappearance, Virilio takes up an observation by Aldous Huxley that many people in the Western world wear sunglasses not just as a mean of protection against bright sunlight, but also in twilight and in the dimly lighted hallways of public buildings. Virilio concludes from this that light, which we experience in itself agreeable, appears threatening when it comes to us from projectors, monitors, or other artificial forms of illumination, since we associate them with weapons. In order not to be flooded with images, to be surprised by the blurring and intensive light of projectors, some Westerners protect their retinas with dark glasses. Artificial light as a weapon was already an alluring focus of attention in Star Wars with its laser swords, in Matrix, the transmission of the destructive machines that threatened to destroy Neo's submarines, give a wonderful firework as he awakened by the power of love to a new life. But fireworks still greet the new year and are supposed to hold evil spirits at bay. So these are some aspects. Also, Yayoi Kusama, that's a photo I did in the Louisiana Museum in near Copenhagen, is a intense space. What is dealing also with, you get into swindle if you enter this space and if you really try to find, because it's always mirrors and some light balls. Of course, Kitty Krause, and I found out that she presented this works her piece also at Matrix 158. Yeah. Never heard about this space, but it was nice. Yeah?
The Wadsworth Athenaeum. It's the Wadsworth Athenaeum.
Okay.
Yeah.
Never heard. And then, of course, the last thing, that if you go back to Borges and the idea of the Aleph, because that's a short story he wrote in 1949, I guess where hidden in a basement, in a special building, or in a building of a poet, is hidden the Aleph. And the Aleph is like a black hole, but an illuminated hole, where all the dots of the world are concentrated or compiled in one dot. And of course, some artists or some other people, like here is another explanation, but try to bring maybe flesh to this only words which are written by Borges. And these are letters now, what you see in this earth-like ball. But this is also, of course, a new world, I think, that we all have this. And that was nice also in your last image in this urban scenery, because there was this cell phone or iPad was also illuminating the scenery. And of course, the new world is really like, or the Aleph 2 could be the new situation of our screens or information desk everywhere. So that's a short overview, but hopefully some negative aspects and some ideas. Now, because I think also pollution, this light pollution is very important, and a lot of architects, urbanists and so, think about this aspects of light pollution, and I think we feel it. We see it every night.
Thanks. Thank you. this huge guilt, you know, stop, we have to stop.
Yes.
So it's, and completely, the lighting community is totally there, and, you know, I think people are trying to come up with ideas for how to create darkness.
Yeah. Do you want to join us at the table?
Sure.
In fact, I wanted to say a few more words about darkness also, because the show at the Goethe is called We Would Provide Complete Darkness, which is a fairly strange sentence. It's definitely not from Borges.
Yeah.
And it came about in a conversation with Wenzel and Sarah Stevenson, who's also working at the Goethe, because it was really a main preoccupation to make Kitty Krause's work in the space. And Kitty kept on insisting that there had to be complete darkness. And so Sarah, who's at the Goethe, said that we promised we would provide complete darkness. And it was, in fact, fairly difficult. And it's a space that is kind of just a storefront that goes in deep and doesn't have many side windows. So it's not easy, even just, you know, in the lower Manhattan, a built environment. Which then leads me to make a few general observations about what you saw, because you know, I announced this event as kind of being about light, but in fact it's a lot about darkness. Amy's first film, Wonder Wheat, is kind of an intervention in darkness. We just
think of
every once in a while get some light. Linnea works at night. That's kind of your starting ground.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you're also trying to, or you looked a bit at the flip side of what, you know, a lit environment is, or how it becomes available. So, I don't know, Amy, maybe you want to say a few more things about your film.
We
you were talking
yeah.
to Sina and Jeff in the back, but I don't know if everybody heard it. And then probably also say a few words about the color, because colored light is also something that I think we need to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. What I said when I was back there is that, like, we basically experienced this film in three ways. So we first experienced the sound of light without any image, and then we saw the image without any sound, and then the last was actually the articulation of what you see and what you hear is really the same. Should I repeat everything? Or? Okay. Then, so I was dealing, in my early films, I was dealing really with, like, in the history of Lenoir, like, really directly with film as light. So they were all cameraless. And thinking a lot about the sound of light. Like, in Lenoir, I think you have an example of how he's still looking at cinema, though, and, like, creating, you know, putting a soundtrack to the image. And so I thought, like, let's just deal with directly what light sounds like. That was interesting to me, because my background also has to do a lot with sound. Not, you know, I'm sort of have a music history to my life. So those things sort of drove my early films. And then I went into this project you talked about with Drew Heitzler, where I was using the camera to record an image again. And that was from 2004 to 2008. I did this really long feature-length film. I was using the camera again for recorded image, and as soon as I finished that, I made landscape film. And I was really thinking about this interference between, like, surface, which was basically my first sort of obsession, and then camera as recorded image again. And I think what you see in landscape film are these interests that I have first in, like, sort of that conflict between, like, surface and recorded image, but then also this, like, constant interference, you know? I mean, I definitely sort of think of light as psychic space, which was interesting, like, when you were talking and how, because we're all meeting for the first time tonight, which is interesting, but, you know, light is psychic space, the landscape is psychic space, and then also the physical part of 16mm, which I think related to, well, I should say that the portrait of landscape film is a Native American burial ground outside of St. Louis, Missouri, which is where I'm from. So it was all of these things sort of acting at once, and I was interested in, like, the interference of all of these things, and then, how light sort of takes, like, all of these different forms. So, and it's sort of a poetic and, like, you know,
intuitive sort of gesture at the same time too, but you know, that's the...
Yeah, I mean, the color washes definitely give away your interest in psychic understanding of the space.
Psychic understanding, but also it was like a and surface, an interruption, you know.
Which leads me... Sorry, Gregor, go ahead.
I think what we saw, or maybe in this Lin Li movie, it was, of course, this game, this play.
Yeah.
And in her movies, of course, it was more the conceptual idea of what light can be. I think it's more as a like, because what the difference, if the painters used light always as an illusion. They use the pigments, but now light is light. Also a filmmaker uses light as light. So, and then, of course, they played with it in the very beginning in the 20s and 30s. But then, like, maybe it started in the 60s, they really tried to find out what light is. And it was not just a play anymore. It was more this, or what landscape can be if it's documented by a movie. So then the light is different from what a painter is doing. And maybe that's...
And also attention to the machine, because, like, all of those things are also so connected to, like, mechanics also, like the physical
process as well. But would you allow to project your movie on a DVD?
And when I presented that on DVD, something really interesting happens. It becomes much more psychic, it becomes silent, it's not necessarily physical anymore. And when I presented it on DVD, I made a soundtrack for it, if this is a landscape film, then I sort of made like sound for landscape, because there's I don't know.
But the reading of the DVD is, of course, laser light.
I know. Yeah, completely.
But that's not okay.
Different.
I think it's yeah, exactly.
Well, it's completely different. Yeah. No, because I mean, the image that we see when it's 16 millimeter, it's actually like the light is shooting through the material, and so like with DVD, it's like bouncing back into your face. So, I think of 16 millimeter and digital as like two incredibly different animals, and I think of one as physical and one as really a psychic. Like one is really vapor, you know.
Makes it sense without physical
landscape. It's different. I guess you can say. I tried not to. I guess the idea to let it translate to DVD was. It changed. All of a sudden, there was a new soundtrack for the film, and then. I think of light as such a. Collaboration, it's such a variable form, like it's always sort of reacting to architecture, it's always sort of bouncing off wall, it's like it really never sort of can exist singularly. So I like to carry that approach to light within contexts, so it's like so, you know, if doing a project with a place that can't use 16 millimeter and doesn't understand how, then I try to it won't be the same experience, so I try to change the work so that it is definitely something different, not just like an echo, but you know, like I let it sort of take a different form, but I do allow it to morph somehow and fit different contexts, different different places.
You and Linnea were having a conversation earlier this evening about colored light. And, I mean, of course, your landscape film very much suggests us thinking about light in a colored form. But, Linnea, you actually made a remark about the materiality and light designers, or us common folk, not really being very aware of colored light. So I wonder if you could say a few more words about that. Also, I've seen projects of yours where you use a lot of color and you don't really want to intervene very much in people's environments, but I feel when you see all of a sudden a public space with a blue atmosphere, for example, it does shock you. Mm-hmm. And you're the one who actually introduced me to the term of soft fascination, which is something that I think we could also talk about with Gregor's presentation. Mm-hmm. So I wonder if you have a few things to say about the use of color in your practice.
I'm looking over at Alex. It's I mean, we work in my practice. We work in chroma, which means in degrees of white, and with the end of 1 degree of white being a very, very pale blue, mm-hmm. which allows you to use a lot less light than if you push over into the redder part of the spectrum. So partly our firm is trying to work between warms and cools of light, and not introduce color into lighting equipment. So I think I just wanted to make that clear, because we're not really known for our use of color. Mm-hmm. Other people are much more. I think you made a really interesting comment, I mean, it has to do with materiality. A lot of the issues that I think many of us have with colored light is that it's in a sense, if you use it in the landscape, in the real landscape or in architectural environments, you're imposing another level that doesn't acknowledge the material surface. It's light, colored light that has, in some sense, no real tangible relationship to the surface. So, you know, you see buildings all over New York where people are literally color changing, but it's meaningless because it doesn't relate to what the physical surface is. It doesn't bond or fuse in the way that you're saying. So I think that makes us extremely careful. And also there is a lot of people who are talking about colored light as a treatment modality for depression or, you know, schizophrenia or autism, and it's a very early, at best, science. So this idea of introducing a lot of it, like as a dosage or as a way of treating people's mental states, I think we're sort of highly suspicious of. But I also think LED light, colored lights, really do bleed out the actual life of the materials that they project on. But that's kind of subjective. Mm-hmm. And if you want to say hard fascination and soft fascination, I mean, I think in a way, you could say there's a difference between what Gregoire is showing. What I'm talking about is those are destinations. Mm-hmm. There are places that you go, and they are meant to fascinate you. And they are indeed fascinating, which is why they become so popular, because they bring the brain directly to the object. And then, of course, they're interpreted, you know, with, you know, great style and creativity. A lot of our work is more, if it's fascinating, it's softly fascinating, because it's sort of out here, and we try very hard not to get anyone to kind of do this. We don't want people to turn their head and look at our work. So it's like, it's not the opposite in a negative way, it's just a very different mode of perception.
But in my eyes, color has a lot to do with temperature. Uh-huh. You know, because when you install a space, like for a museum, an exhibition space, of course you can try a lot of different white colors. It starts, I don't know, the Osram 840, 850, 860, and 900, mm-hmm. and so on. And we tried it in several spaces. And for example, we did it with Josef Albers. You know, we put some Albers in the different temperature of white colors, and they look totally different. Mm-hmm. But it takes time, and that, of course, and we normally think, well, we want that people stay 1 hour in the space or in the museum, and then we use like a speaker. You don't use a more brilliant speaker, you mm-hmm. use the balanced speaker. You know, mm-hmm. That is the same with the color, mm-hmm. in my mm-hmm. eyes, but mm-hmm. especially with white color.
Yeah.
That's temperature, and of course it's important.
Yes.
As an artist working between like Europe and New York, it's so interesting, the fluorescent versus the halogen, although it's changing, mm-hmm. you know,
yeah.
between the ways to look at art and viewing art, and like
yeah.
that sort of umbrella we're supposed to
yeah.
see it or not see it in. And then going to the Dia, where it's all natural light, like
mm-hmm.
if you go up to Dia Beacon, I was like thinking about all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of artists also will then take all the lights out and then work with, like, Dia Beacon, you know, just sunlight, then, like, take it all away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Those are all interesting.
Yeah, and this artist, in fact, Kitty Krause, she uses old-style light bulbs, which in Germany, I guess, you can no longer buy, and she has to go onto eBay to still find them. So when she came and did her piece here, it was actually quite easy for us because we can still find them in your regular hardware store. So
and
that's also a practicality.
Mm. Mm-hmm. I was just thinking.
Yeah, the European Union made this law, no, that now, I think after we had the 100 watt is already forbidden, now it's a 60,
mm-hmm.
and in 2 years a 40. What is not, you cannot buy them, they are forbidden. But you, I don't know. And the other thing is that these light art installations, we have this tax reduce art, 7%.
Percentage for the arts.
With light art, they don't accept it anymore. They say that's design. So they take 19% tax.
Huh.
That's totally crazy.
That's fascinating.
I see.
Tax.
Yeah.
Food and art and some books. And
then the regular rate is 19%.
Right.
And light art is not art anymore.
Right.
It's like design, so that's why
the
higher rate applies.
So did
they
have that awful problem with importing the
artworks
and having to pay that
very
high tax?
No.
I think that was
England.
Yeah.
We are not selling.
Yeah, it was a Flavin importing. Extra tax.
I wonder if you all would like to join the conversation, in fact, if there are...
I have a question to Linnea after. When you were talking about this meeting with the police department
mm-hmm.
in this alley and then the lighting designer for the police department,
mm-hmm.
in the context of what you're talking about here, in the context of art, the police play, all that
mm-hmm.
stuff,
your expert... No, I'm scared.
You're scared. We're recording it, so we won't hear you at all.
And the context of what we're talking about, how would you place that experience of yours and that situation?
Do you know, it was actually, it really, sorry, there's not an easier way, it totally slapped me up the side of my head. It really did. You know, because here I've been talking about, you know, in other kind of lecture forums about using less light and finding different ways. You know, of using surfaces and reflection and all the ways we could use less light. And I have to say, in the middle of our tour, we were at the bottom of a very, in almost like a parking lot. And when we looked up, we could see that there were a pack of children, maybe 8 or 10 years old, who were all running together. And they came to the top of the stairs and they screamed down at us, "Who are you? Who are you?" And the police with us said, "We're the police." They said, and they couldn't quite hear it, and they kept saying, "We're scared of you. We're really scared of you. Who are you?" And I thought, you know, I've been walking around sort of, you know, talking about people carrying portable light and we should have lanterns, and that's been what I've been talking about for a couple of years. And I thought, Jesus, you know, this is actually really a problem. These kids actually can't see who I am. And I've got to engage that. I have to rethink how lighting actually does function in a real sort of, in a very sort of specific and site-specific way. And I came back and I really have been thinking about it ever since and thinking, I'm not going to position myself in some sort of abstract way around good lighting, bad lighting, we want the good light.
Mm.
It's like, I don't really think I want to talk about it in those ways anymore. I want to think about it very much to the situation. Does that help? Does that answer your question? Well, actually, I think we've decided we can solve the problem of lighting the stairway unless we solve the problem of lighting around it, because if we just light the stairway, then that becomes actually a place that people could be seen and under surveillance. And because of what's happening, there are people kind of perched nearby, and that was very apparent, really like sort of, you know, and then they pounce. You know, this stuff is also, you know, becoming more real in St. Louis. It's becoming more real in lots of places. People are turning the lights out. So you really have to start to think about, well, what does it mean? You know, it's not just a question of sustainability and conservation. It's also a question of that a lot of lighting has so much symbolic meaning, mm-hmm. and so much it means the city cares about you, and it means you feel safe. Whether you are safe is another issue. So I think we have to be sort of like speed up our thinking about this and make it deeper, because it's not going to be just about changing light bulbs over to LEDs. It's really going to be about life, urban life, and what does that look like in an age where there isn't a lot of extra cash around.
In the Syracuse project, actually, Linnea, do you use older infrastructure, don't you? Or you're actually working with the Cobra heads that we all find.
Yeah,
so
we got there and they were like, oh, you know, there was a previous lighting designer who's an incredible lighting designer, and I'm a great admirer of his work. But in the early iteration, all of the Cobra heads were replaced with these beautifully designed red lights, and they, you know, it just wasn't possible. And so when we came, we were like, leave the Cobra heads. Why? What are you going to do with them? Put them in the trash? They work really well. They're incredibly efficient. Why do we have to design something new? So then let's try something else. Let's try putting light in the garages, of which there are so many. So that's kind of where we're thinking about new technology, not so much to replace what works, because we should keep that, but to kind of amplify the experience.
I don't think, and there was any conversation that would include the phrase light pollution more than 2 or 3 years ago. I mean, that's a very recent conversation that's entered the public domain, and people talking about using less light. These are new concepts compared to the, you know, the history of modern times.
No, that's true. And I mean, actually, Cabinet published an amazing article about 4 years ago, which was written, I'm going to say her name, Catherine, it's on the ecological disaster of nighttime lighting as it affects other species. And we're talking, you know, everything, everybody kind of knows the problem with turtles, and some people know the problem with birds, but what most people don't realize is that we're now sort of affecting zooplankton. We're distorting habitat. So there's a lot of really smart people who are thinking about it, because the night sky people are like, whoa, we got to stop putting light on the sky. Let's just throw it at the ground. It's like, whoa, we're beginning to have some real problems with that. So there is. This is new, but it isn't like a one-dimensional issue that you just have to put shields on top of everything. That's not going to work either. So it's rethinking lighting in public space completely, I think.
I'm not paranoid about microphones, but I think there is a parallel between the sound and light.
Yeah.
And I think Occupy Wall Street, for example, this mic check and this sort of multiple way of dealing with sound without amplification that proved a certain kind of efficiency of humans when they have to devise, you know, other ways of amplifying themselves, and multiple waves of amplification if you need to make it louder. Mm-hmm. Perhaps in this, what you showed in the self-carried lights, you know, earlier, and kind of that system, development of that system, and what it would mean to forego the big lanterns and big, you know, Times Square banners. I mean, what would it mean for our, as we were talking about psychic space?
I think it's a great parallel. I wonder what you think.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, like light is sound, and when we were talking about how people are switching over to different kinds of lighting, I mean, maybe because I'm more sensitive, like I definitely hear the sound of fluorescent light, you know, but then also just like a way of, you know, it is like light, you know, light is a noise. I mean, it is carrying your attention, like it does direct you. I mean, even like the lighting right now, right here, I mean, it's like maybe obvious to say, but it's like, you know, and like, you know, so.
We need sunglasses.
Yeah. Yeah, like balance that, you know, but like power, I mean, so many things are sort of articulated with those things that we don't necessarily, like in a subtle way, or that you're probably even closely.
No, well, there's this incredible German researcher who's been miking LEDs, and he brings them out, and he's like, would you want that going through your body? And when you put a mic on an LED, it makes a fluorescent sound like a butterfly wing. It's like really noisy.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think it's a wonder, I think it's a great book, I think that's a great thing about thinking about what is the parallel to people just talking and not using a mic. It's a really interesting idea for light and sensitivity to sound.
And power too, and like and sort of control. I mean also.
Yeah.
Like in a way.
Who controls the light and who controls the sound?
But also I think the microphone was interesting because these are all weapons. So Paul Virilio is right. No, really, media is a weapon. So light, if we understand really light as a medium, then it's a weapon.
Right. Well, that's
and we have to take care.
Light feels violent to me in the morning. Yeah. I mean, that's sort of what I was saying. Like I have like layers of curtains and things because I do have to stay up like till 1 o'clock in the morning now. Mm-hmm. That like if the sun bothers me before I've had enough rest, like I'm really bothered by like if someone doesn't have a curtain, if like mm-hmm. If you're not trying to sort of work somehow within the way we've done that.
Yeah, on that note, I don't know, maybe it's time to actually drop the curtain. I don't know how much longer our hosts here at Cabinet want to stick it out, but it's getting very warm. Maybe there is some time for an informal conversation without speakers and without projectors. Thank you all very much for coming. This was a wonderful conversation.